Now, of course, the question that is for all of you is, of course, who are your imaginary friends? I had two that were primaries, you know, people that I was with a lot, Harmy and Hatsum. I can't remember the exact flow of it. My dad might be able to help me later. But one was a dairy farmer, and the other was an air traffic controller. Pretty cool occupations, if you think about it. And this was when we lived in Springwood, so you see probably how the dairy farmer fits in. Still interesting about the air traffic controller, except that it's pretty cool to think about being in a tower and controlling planes. When we were little, son George used to always call the air traffic control tower the remote control tower. You know, like they were actually flying the planes from up there. I love imagination. I think it's an incredible gift from God for all of us to immerse ourselves. You know, they call it Lectio Divina, if anybody's ever practice that in the reading of scriptures. That's just a fancy church word for inviting you into the story. How do you do that? Well, you don't do it through like a beaker or math problems. You do it with your imagination. Imagining yourself on the banks of the river beside Jesus, or along the trail to Galilee with the followers, or in the crowds, etc. And I think imagination's tough, though, as we get older, right? Because our rational brain comes in and we're like, we got to be sort of serious about things. We got to sort of suppress those childlike impulses. And that's why the late 60s and 70s rock band Creedence Clearwater Revival is such an incredible shot in the arm. They were most assuredly composing and singing songs in a very turbulent time in American history. Wars and political corruption and civil rights dominated the headlines. And if you think about it, sort of dominates our headlines today in many ways. But their imagination, the way that they would sing these songs with the rhythms, would invite you into the music. The theologian John Fogerty even wrote, "Every writer will tell you, you sit down and face your blank sheet of paper. It is the most freeing thing in the world and the most terrifying. You see, that blank page is a window to infinity. You can go anywhere, do anything, create something that has never existed before. It's curiosity and imagination all mixed up. With a lot of luck, pixie dust, and here's the kicker, tons of prayers." His words. Tons of prayers. One moment you have nothing, the next moment God has given you a masterpiece. It's just plain scary. Beautiful example, if you haven't listened to it in a while, of his incredible imagination comes from that great song, "Looking Out My Back Door." Some of you remember that song? Looking out my back door. The great line is this one: "Tambourines and elephants are playing in the band. Won't you take a ride on the flying spoon?" How about that? Picture that for a second. I mean, even if you just picture a tambourine and an elephant's playing, not to mention, you know, Willis flying around on a spoon. Lectio Divina, getting into the story. If we put ourselves into today's gospel story, if we put ourselves besides James and John or those sons of Zebedee, you picture maybe the warmth over your face of that Middle Eastern air and the strong breeze. Maybe a little bit of sand is burning. Could be midday because you're not fishing, you're repairing the nets waiting for later. And at some point, your eyes must glaze up and see the one whose eyes have been beaming on you. And you catch a glimpse of God, of Jesus looking at you, calling you by name, inviting you into his world. Those eyes must be the eyes of someone that instantly knows you even better than yourself. Think about the eyes of a consoling parent or a teacher that has known you all too well, or a coach who has seen you through ups and downs, a friend that knows you. Those are the eyes of Jesus on these fishermen. Those are the eyes of Jesus on us as we transport ourselves into the story. And then we hear the first half of another incredible line of Scripture. Follow me. This injunction from Jesus. It doesn't come across as a command at all, does it? It comes across as an invitation. An invitation to surrender to Him. An invitation to surrender our pursuit of salvation. To accept the work of Jesus on the cross, in other words. To let go of our own desire to save ourselves and allow the One to save us. That's the invitation to follow me. That's the eyes that are calling us into His relationship for us. And it's so important that you start with that injunction before we get to the next, which is to focus on the fishing for men. Because what it means is that in Jesus, we hear the good news. In Jesus, we are accepted and encouraged by Him, and then able to go out and fish for others. Able, in other words, to be in relationship with one another. 1 John writes, we love precisely because He loved us first. It starts with God's love. It starts with God's grace. It starts with surrendering, following Him. And that enables us again to love one another, creating this new ethic that's based upon love. Now, this sounds really beautiful, right? In our little Lectio Divina, we're all sitting in the bank in first century Palestine, and Jesus' eyes are looking at us. But it's really hard. It's partly hard because we all tend to gravitate towards the second injunction, right? The second part of that statement, because that doesn't involve surrendering. That involves our actions, getting out there and putting some elbow grease into it and pulling our bootstraps up. And that's a natural thing for us all. We love that. Except that's not what Jesus is telling us. He's saying, first and foremost, you need to follow Him. You follow Him by surrendering your life to Him. And notice that when you talk about this, it's not abstract. I love this part of this line. It's not abstract. He doesn't say, y'all, come on with y'all. He doesn't say, follow the church. He doesn't say, follow these teachings. He doesn't say, you need to follow these written directives or you need to follow this map. He says, follow me. It's a personal relationship to start with Jesus. It is following Him, not beliefs, but following the One who came to save. And it becomes life-changing because it becomes a relationship then between you and Him. Pronouns. Between you and Him. Between us. And this is what Jesus is inviting us into a relationship between Jesus and you, Jesus and me, between us. There's a beautiful, beautiful example of this found in the Christmas film, The Holdovers, which we watched this past weekend. So if you haven't seen it yet, I'm sorry, because I'm going to spoil the whole movie. But it's still really good. You've had time to see it, in fairness, right? It's been out for a while. It's really, really good. And it shows in a subtle way this incredible link between surrendering, between giving up and creating a relationship to God, and how that then transforms your relationship with others. Because if what Jesus is really getting at in this great statement of follow me and I will teach you to fish for people, it is that you surrender to me and I will change your relationships. I will refresh, I will restart your heart so that you can love and be in community with one another. So the holdovers, it's so very good. And I'll just start with sort of the big picture of it. It's about a New England boarding school and filmed in New England. And as a side note, the director, Alexander Payne, said, I just used an old film to make it look like it was filmed in 1970 because New England hasn't changed a bit. It's pretty good. And I love New England for all those reasons. So anyway, it's about a boarding school. And it's about a sort of curmudgeonly professor who has been under flack from the board and the headmaster because he failed the senator's son in ancient Civ the year before. And he's not really playing the game, and he calls them all Philistines. And that's played by Paul Giamatti. And it's just he does an incredible job. It's hilarious. And he's all about the rules. He gives them a Marco Aurelius book for their Christmas presents, as an example. And so he's just hammering them. He believes in the law, in other words. And because of these tensions, he is the one sentenced to stay on campus for Christmas break with the holdovers. So that's where the title comes from. The kids who don't have families to go back to for Christmas. So here is this professor, and Angus is his name. And so they start with what you would expect is a whole lot of vitriol and just yelling and unhappiness. And then you have a moment where Angus has disappeared. And the professor Hunnam is his name, gets up and he doesn't know where he is, and he's responsible. And he's like, the manual says for holding over, you got to stay in this building on campus and nowhere else. So he's running all around the building, and he finds Angus in the gymnasium where he's not supposed to be. And Angus is running and does like a pole vault type of move. And then you hear this screaming and yelling because he's come down on his shoulder and separated his shoulder. So they go to the ER, and Professor Hunnam is just beside himself because he's going to get fired. He was responsible for this young man, and he's broken his shoulder or separated it. So you get to the scene where the doctor is saying, how did this happen, young man? And Angus looks up at him and says, well, I can't go into a lot of detail because this is my dad's weekend to be with me, and I got to spend Christmas with my mom. My dad doesn't have insurance, and I was playing on the pond, and I was playing ice hockey, and I slipped and fell, and my dad had told me not to do this. In other words, he invents this story, and all of a sudden, you see the doctor say, well, okay, it's just a separated shoulder. We'll get it fixed, and you all can go out, and you see this mean, law-driven professor, you know, his affect changed for the first time. Angus is told a lie, a white lie, arguably, but he's misrepresented something to cover up a mistake that Dunham had made. And it's just an incredible moment where they get back into the car, and the school was called Barton Academy. And Hunnam goes, you know, Angus, young man, Barton men don't lie. And Angus is like, I just saved your job. And there's this long pause. And then Hunnam looks at him and says, entre nous. I think I got that French right. It means between us. And all of a sudden, their entire relationship changes. Everything they then do falls under the term entre-nous, between us. And by the end of the film, you see this young man who was suffering from depression, who had no way to go and was about to be kicked out of this boarding school. You see him begin to flourish as a young man. And you see this professor, for the first time, beginning to have the impact on this young man that he's really wanted to have all along. But the screaming and the yelling and the thumping never worked. But the agent of grace does. They create this judgment-free zone between us. It's an incredibly beautiful film. And I won't spoil the very end for you, just to leave you there, and go back to the text. When Jesus is inviting us into a relationship, that's what he is creating between us. Entre nous. In that relationship, then we can go out and love our neighbor and be with our friends, be in our church community, remembering that we first and foremost have surrendered ourselves to the one who came to save. Amen.